Today, let us roll all our strength up into a ball of poetry.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I know that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but I think it will by the time we read our first poem today. Occasionally I have the opportunity just to, you would think it's my podcast. You would think I just do whatever I want all the time. And I do sort of, but some days I feel a little freer than other days just to have some fun. And today is one of those days. So we're going to read poetry and hopefully you are inclined to hang around and listen to these poems. I've picked out five today. I doubt we'll get to all five, but we might. I hope we do, because they go together. If we get all the way through them, they go together really well. But these cover 250 years or so in the time that they're written. From Andrew Marvel, beginning, he's a 17th century poet, meaning the 1600s, and then down to Matthew Arnold, a realist from the mid-19th century. And some romantic poetry in between. I'm not a big fan of romantic poetry normally, but I picked out some that I think will be worth reading. Romantic doesn't have anything to do with people being in love with each other, by the way. So it's different thing. You can come back for that. Except the problem is the first poem is about two people and about love. However, it's about a lot more than that. So hang with me through it, and I think it will be worthwhile. I've actually mentioned it before because in another freewheeling episode, we talked about T.S. Eliot's Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. We didn't cover everything in that poem, but we covered a few things in it. And always, if I'm talking about that poem, I bring up his reference, in T.S. Eliot's reference, to Andrew Marvel's poem to his coy mistress, which is just a brilliant, beautiful, hilarious, powerful poem. It just puts it all together. It's just so great. You can tell. I'm a huge fan. And this poem, it's really great. So I'm going to read it to you. I want you to hear the poem. That's how poetry is supposed to be had anyway, that you hear it and process it in that way. But at the same time, you can't just hear a poem and get it. So I'll read it to you, and then I'll go back through it, and we'll talk about parts of it. I will paraphrase one tiny part of the poem because we're a family show. And it's not terrible. It's not anything you wouldn't find in Song of Solomon, but that should explain it. So why I'm going to paraphrase that one line. It's not even a whole line. I'm going to paraphrase two words, right? Won't make any difference to the overall meaning of the poem. So here we go from Andrew Marvel, a poem called To His Coy Mistress. You know what coy is, right? So standoffishness to a mistress who's being standoffish. To his coy mistress. Here we go. And let me tell you, this is one of the best poems in the English language. And that's not just me. This is a great poem. So here we go. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou, by the Indian Ganges side, should rubies find. I, by the tide of Umber, would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood. And you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. And 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze. 200 to adore, I now paraphrase, but 30,000 to the rest. an age at least to every part. And the last age should show your heart. For lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at a lower rate. But at my back, I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song. Then worms shall try that long-preserved, other paraphrase, and your quaint honor turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Now, therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires, now let us sport us while we may, and now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour than languish in his slow-chapped power. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball and tear our pleasures with rough strife through the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our sun stand still, yet we will make him run. This poem is so funny and just so, so compelling. So first of all, let's just get past the love part of it. Is beautiful. It's fantastic. I mean, it'd be nice for a card if somebody could, you know, produce a card that had enough of it on there that you could make sense of it. You know, it's great as a love song. It's kind of great. Or, you know, in the same sense as John Donne's To a Flea, you know, when he's talking, or I think it's just called A Flea or The Flea, something like that, when he's trying to do the same thing, encourage someone not to be so coy in their relationship with him. And this is from that same era. Same thing. So, but let's put that aside for a minute, because the profundity of the poem is not that. It is, I mean, that's present, but it's just the example of the things a person wants to encounter, wants to experience in the in the way you want to experience it. Oh, man, I can't wait to study this for 1,000 years. But I don't have 1,000 years. So how am I going to get to it? It doesn't matter what the activity it is, except for this, that love is chosen because it's such a profound activity. It's the one that drives us through life. I mean, even when God is describing for us what our lives are supposed to be about, it's love. And I know not just marital love or the intimacy that comes with it, but it is that and that ultimate expression of it that poets are getting at when they're drawn to that relationship, to that passion and so on, as a way of talking about anything in life that would draw us or ignite our passions or our engagement, our involvement, doing, you know, that's the thing. And so if we were to replace, so I don't know how much of the poem you got in one reading. I hope it was fairly clear enough. I tried to read it in a way that was pretty straightforward. But, you know, it's a guy on one side of the river saying, oh, you can stand on that side of the river, I'll stand on this side of the river. From before Noah's flood, I'd be willing to love you from afar and take all of the time until Christ's return, the conversion of the Jews, for you to respond in any way whatsoever. And even then, take hundreds of years just to look at your forehead and describe each little mark on it and enjoy every moment. You know, it's that kind of poem. And as he's going through that, he ends up at this line that I want to come back to, but it's at the line about rolling our strength and sweetness up into one ball, which I'll come back to in a minute. But in the middle of it, you know, the thing that chases us down and reminds us of time is not that we get more mature. We're fine with that. We'd love to grow more mature all the time. I say all the time about my own interests. you know, what do you want to study? I want to study everything. I want to know everything. And the great disappointment of life is realizing that no matter how hard I study, no matter what I look up, no matter what I find out, no matter what, and whether it's research or just casual enjoyment, no matter how much I learn, I'm going to run out of time before I run out of things to learn. And I know that seems like it's just a part of human nature, but it's also a part of human nature to have that desire that our reach exceeds our grasp is part of what it means to be human. And that's part of what's going on here. If you find a thing so valuable that you wish you could give eternity to it, then realizing that that thing isn't, you don't have eternity to get to it. What does that do to you? You know, what response does that bring to you? Does it make you admire it from a distance patiently in the way the coy mistress is doing? Or does it instead make you chase it down? I'm going to find it now. I want to do something about it. And the thing that reminds us that we only have so much time is always the same thing. It motivates us all the time. Death. Even the book of Hebrews says that's the thing that through fear governs our whole lifetime, which is death itself, the grave, the thing that Jesus conquers in the resurrection. So when we're reading this poem, it doesn't have to be about the infatuation with a woman or trying to talk her into being active with him now instead of putting him off or trying to be patient and waiting until there's some beautiful conclusion to the matter. But instead, this statement right at the end that says, you know, instead of that, let's do something now. And so the line, let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball. That line, that's the thing that T.S. Eliot appeals to in The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which is a poem on this same theme. I mean, that's not a surprise because he appeals to this poem. He actually refers to it. I mean, he actually quotes it. But in his poem, you know, that's the whole question. Will somebody get up and actually do something? Are you actually going to go out? Are you actually going to get dressed and find someone and have an evening away and take the risk of an emotional relationship that may or may not actually create an attachment? And in that case, it doesn't even create an attachment. But the point is, you did something. But that would be the goal, to do something. But in this, the point is for Andrew Marvel, you know, to be able to say in the poem, let's not just sit and wait to see what's going to happen eventually. And if I can just, I mean, it's just a relaxed episode, right? So I'm going to editorialize for a second here and say it. It took me decades to get to a point in my life where I would say to myself, I was still a young man at the time, but it took decades to get to a point where I would say to myself, why are you so afraid to just go do the thing that you wish you could do? Just go do it. I mean, what's the harm? What's the risk? Are you going to give up the opportunity to actually to accomplish something so that you can maintain the nothingness of having done nothing? That's not the way to live this very brief life with time's winged chariot hurrying near. And I'm not saying throw all caution to the wind, and I am so grateful for people who are risk-averse, you know, and extremely cautious in their decision-making and deliberate and intentional about it and so on. I'm very grateful for that. But they still are doing things. They're evaluating and determining what they should do. But still, I'm extremely grateful for that. I am extremely grateful for the insane entrepreneurially minded who are out taking risks every moment of every day of their life, even though sometimes they fail. And in their failure, they're hurt sometimes. And sometimes the people around them are hurt as well in that process. I get that. There's risk involved in moving forward with something. I'm not entrepreneurial. That's not me. That's just not my nature at all. I have developed in my life the ability not to be so risk averse that I'm frozen and can't do anything. When I take risks, I don't sleep at night, but I prefer not to sleep at night than to find myself sleeping in a grave and having to answer to God saying, well, I know, God, you gave me 61. I've at least got that many years. I don't know how many it'll be. Maybe 61 and a half, 61 and three quarters. Can I go for 64? Anybody for 64? Anyway, the point is, whatever age I get to, I don't want to stand up in front of God and say, well, you only gave me 64 years. I didn't have time to do anything really that would take, you know, that would lead to some change, that would make something happen. And that is the point here. That things can remain the same, grow at a vegetable rate or slower. That's what he calls it, you know. You can feel like something's happening, but then your life just comes and goes just like that. And I don't think God wants us to stand in front of him and say, well, at least I didn't take any risks. And again, I'm not advertising for just taking insane risks. But I think almost everyone I've ever known, and I wish I could say everyone, but I just can't remember everyone I ever knew. But all the ones I know of, all the ones I can think of, I've had so many conversations like this where really the crux of the issue was simply, well, are you willing just to get up and do it? I mean, sometimes it's a college student who's trying to decide whether they, you know, have fallen in love enough to ask if they should get married. And sometimes it's about whether they're going to go to another school or, you know, start a career in this place or take this job or that job or, you know, whatever, where you live at this house or that house. And, you know, very often it's just trying to get them to remember that they have agency. You can do something. And this poem is just begging people to do something with this marvelous but very short life that we've been blessed with. And, you know, the way he puts it, he's not saying our lives are short. He's saying time is moving awfully quickly. So let's decide whether to keep up with time or not to keep up with it. You know, that's the closing line. We can't make our sun stand still. There's nothing you can do that stops that ensuing, for some people, they would think of it as enemy, right? There's nothing you can do to just stop it. We cannot make our sun stand still. We don't get to be the Old Testament and hold up the arms of, you know, and make sure that the light stays until the battle is won. We don't get to do that. We don't get to send the dial back up the steps 10 degrees with Hezekiah. We don't get to do that. But we can make him run to keep up. You know, we can just be doing stuff to make him run to keep up. I wish I were more like that. I'm not. I'm trying. I try to take those steps and try to make that run. I work with a couple of people who are like that. I mean, it's hard to keep up with. It is really hard to keep up with. It helps. It drags me forward and makes me do more. So if you're one of those people that is trying to stand on the other side of the Ganges, you know, and collect Indian rubies, then you would be one to whom I would say, beautiful. I'm happy for you. I'm glad. But don't just stand there your whole life. Make sure you go somewhere, do something. And if you're one of the people that's running everyone else down and telling them it's time to stop waiting, understand where they are and where they're growing as well. I'm for that too. But all of us, you know, even if we can't make our son stand still, let's make him run, you know? Okay, there's one poem. That is Andrew. I encourage you to look these up again. No way you can. I mean, I could go line by line through this, such beautiful language, but I encourage you to do that. To His Coy Mistress by Andrew Marvel. There you go. One poem. Number two. We're going to skip actually a couple of hundred years. A hundred years. We're going to skip forward to a legitimate romantic, the romantic poet, William Wordsworth. Guy who lays the foundation for what romanticism becomes, right? So, and this is, one of his most famous poems. I've read a few lines from this to you before in different episode, but I want to read the whole stanza. I'm not going to read the whole poem. It's a very long poem. But I want to read the lines to you so that you can here, it's just so magnificently written and described. You'll be able to see, you know, what he's envisioning as he describes it. But also because I couldn't disagree more with the basic premise in the metaphysics of this part of the poem, the reality, the cosmos that it describes. I disagree with completely. I don't believe in it at all. And yet there's still a really great truth behind what he's saying and something for us to acknowledge. And so I want to read it to you and then we'll talk about it. This one's William Wordsworth, if I didn't say. Ode, Intimations of Immortality. Fourth, fifth, sixth stanza, somewhere in there. Sorry, I didn't look up the numbers of the stanzas. But anyway, this is, you'll recognize this. These are the most famous lines. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life's star, hath had elsewhere its setting, and cometh from afar. Not in entire forgetfulness, and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home. Heaven lies about us in our infancy. Shades of the prison house, though, begin to close upon the growing boy. But he beholds the light, and whence it flows, he sees in it his joy. Then the youth, who daily farther from the east must travel, still is nature's priest, and by the vision splendid is on his way attended. At length, the man perceives it die away and fade into the light of common day. So this is a consummately romantic poem, by the way, for lots of reasons. And again, I know you only heard it once, so it's almost impossible to get all of the imagery. But if you didn't catch at least this part, you should notice it started with birth. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. And then there are and when we are infants, we are trailing clouds of glory in our birth. That's how it describes it. And then in our infancy, heaven is lying about us. And then there are shades of a prison house closing in on a growing boy. And yet he still sees the light, you know. And then there's the youth who daily farther from the east, which is where we're born. Born in the east, you die in the west, right? It's like the sunrise, sunset. So the youth who daily farther from the east must travel, he's still nature's priest. And he's still attended by this vision that he has from his birth. But at length, man perceives it die away and fade into the light of common day. So we went from birth to infancy to childhood, a boy, to the youth, to the man. And all along the way, we're going from being literally in the presence of God in the way the poem describes it. Now, obviously, the whole poem's a metaphor, but in the poem, the language is we are at home with God. You know, that's our, you know, before our birth. So in our birth, heaven is still lying about us. And then, so he goes through all the stages, and as we're going through them, we grow farther and farther from God. We grow farther and farther from what we were when we were at home with God. Now, obviously, the image there is of incarnation, and it's not foreign to anything in Romanticism, even when Romanticism takes its transcendental form in American culture with Henry David Thoreau or Ralph Waldo Emerson. You know, you're carrying these ideas forward of reincarnation. And certainly Plato, from whom Thoreau, at least, gets a lot of his ideas, it appears, it looks like, in his writings. Plato is a, you know, reincarnationist. He believes in reincarnation. Our souls exist eternally in the heavens, and then we're instantiated as people in the world with that soul, and we're just trying to remember the things we knew in heaven throughout our lives. So this is all very much, you know, that kind of Platonic understanding of the heavens. I don't believe in that at all. So there's nothing redeemable about that description of our lives in terms of understanding who we are as human beings. I don't even think Wordsworth cares whether we would get that from it or not. That's not the goal. But there's something really powerful in this and true. And the way I want you to hear it is in the lines from a different poem. And these are lines that, for some reason or another, really stuck with my son, my oldest son, Philip, that sounded like I was David praying for Absalom, right? My son, my oldest son. It's not his oldest son. Absalom's not. But and that was a terrible circumstance. And this is not. So Philip's perfectly fine. Anyway, the point is, he loved this line, actually included in some of the lyrics he's done in some of his songs. But this line from Wordsworth's poem called My Heart Leaps Up, and I believe that's correct. I think that's where this other poem comes from. And it's lines that I think would apply to us. So think, I'll read them to you in just a moment. But first, I want you to think about what this imagery means to Wordsworth when he says, you know, we're trailing clouds of glory in our birth. So we're coming down from heaven. And so little infants, they're experiencing heaven still. Their little crib, you know, is filled with heaven. And then the older they get, the darker the world gets, the more jaded, we would say, we become. We become wizened, you know. And I mean the lines of age, the wrinkledness that comes with living in this world. But I mean it metaphorically, not about our skin, but, you know, about our souls. We start to shrivel up because we have to restrain ourselves so much. Little kids, like, they're going to rule. They're going to fly to Mars and do. And by the time you're old, it's like, how far is it to my funeral? Can I get there tomorrow? The difference between those two is so staggering. The Wordsworth describes it this way, right? So it's beautiful language. Now, the power of it, I think, resides in this sentiment. And it is, or at least in the moral that's attached to what I'm about to read to you from My Heart Leaps Up. It's these lines, the child is father of the man. I've said that, I don't know how many times on different episodes. The child is father of the man. Such a great line. And I wish my days to be bound each to each by natural piety. Now, the second part of that, I'm not going to worry about today. But I do, it is a beautiful sentiment. I wish my days to be bound each to each by natural piety. That is, I don't want just a narrative of life. I want my identity and my values, and not just random values, but piety, having arrived at the thing I'm supposed to be. I want that to be what ties me together from day to day, not just my name, not just my age. Well, this is me, but one day older. No, this is my piety being carried over from one day to the next. And in Romanticism, piety is a lot more than the sense of self-righteousness or something like that in the way we use the word now. But it does have that value, you know, built into it. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is the first line, the child is father of the man. Again, that's from a different poem, My Heart Leaps Up, from Wordsworth. That's a great line, right? Because, you know, the child is younger, obviously, and the man, he's old. So how could the child be the father of the man? Well, which one existed first, right? And this is the point, that I was a child, and then I was a man. It's not like my adulthood determined what my childhood was. My childhood led to my adulthood. And the child is actually the thing from which all of this adulthood emerged. So why not look at it as, you know, my parent? So my childhood is my father. The implication from a romantic like Wordsworth, or I think a lot of romantics would hold this view. A lot of 19th century thinkers, authors, writers would hold this view, that the corruption that we face is because as we get older, we learn the rules everybody else puts on us, and we restrict ourselves to the things that are not us. They're not our calling. They're not what God sent us for or created us for, but they sure make our lives easier as we get along with everyone else. And so the dark clouds, the shades of the prison house begin to close, even on the boy, you know. I'm going to go to, oh, I got to do that instead. You know, the shades begin to close. And again, I know there's a reason for that. Obviously, you got to clean your room. You have to eat the vegetables. I get it. That's great. You have to learn to make a living, not because you need the money, but because if you're a responsible part of a society, you do something worth something to that society. So I value all of that. I love that. I teach it all the time. The shame is if we lose our sense of purpose and calling that comes, forget reincarnation, forget the trailing clouds of glory. I mean, when you're born, wouldn't you think it's a beautiful expression to say I'm trailing clouds of glory? Not because I came from heaven, but because God created me. And so I've got this purpose. I've got this direction that my life needs to go. And don't you think he's right about this? That, you know, when we start out, there's that, I'm going to do everything I'm supposed to do. And by the time we get older, there's this, oh, I can't do any of the stuff I want to do. I'm just going to conform here, make sure I fit in. And if the world were a pristine and utopian place, then what we would be conforming to is a pristine and utopian fulfillment of God's calling on our life. But that's not the world, right? So the world presses in on us, and we become less and less inclined to roll that ball up and do the one thing God actually wanted us to do, to actually force our way through the iron bars of life and do the thing that God wanted us to do. I think it's a pretty powerful statement about not losing our way, no matter how much we have to, you know, work to communicate and fit and produce and respond to the things of life, that we not forget to communicate with and sense and respond to the things of heaven. And it's very hard to hold on to those if you're not seeing them every day. Part of what I'm saying here is, you know, the poem's written with a certain meaning. I mean, the words convey a meaning. That's just there. But that's not what poetry is. It's the push and the pull and the metaphor, the feel and the weight of what's being said that you carry forward. And so in this sort of it's magnificently artistic sense, you know, Wordsworth has something really powerful to say to a perfectly orthodox believer in how we fulfill God's calling on our life in this world. It's hard for me. Look, I don't even like romantic poets, but that's powerful poetry. So what am I going to do? Got to read it. All right, another one. So this one I'm going to read to you because of who we are. All of us will hear this first phrase, the title of this poem, and go, what? That's where that came from? Not all of us, but you know, all of you who've ever read anything by C.S. Lewis will do that. For those of you who haven't, I'm about to read to you the title of a poem by William Wordsworth, which is the title of a book by C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis lived later, just in case you're not clear about which one motivated which. So the name of the poem is Surprised by Joy. By the way, this is a compliment to C.S. Lewis. He didn't steal anything. He used the theme of the poem properly understood, in my opinion, as a way to introduce a book that if a person understood this poem, they would know exactly where the book was going the moment they read the title. And it is where the book goes. So I think it's a brilliant use of this title from William Wordsworth. And I'm not a naive fan of C.S. Lewis. I love his basic premises and the gist of the arguments that he makes. But there are all kinds of cultural influences and nuances to what he says that I'm just like, oh, no. Don't let anybody even read that. But I don't mean that as badly as it sounds, but I do mean it because it's true. There are things that are, but man, this was a great use of a title. Okay, so here's the poem. I know you're like, get to the poem for crying out loud. The poem, here it is, William Wordsworth, Surprised by Joy. Now, and if you think about his book, you'll kind of know where this poem's about to go. Here's the poem. The first words are the title, by the way. I'm not repeating the title. Surprised by Joy. Impatient as the wind, I turned to share the transport. Oh, with whom? But thee, long buried in the silent tomb, that spot which no vicissitude can find. Love, faithful love, recalled thee to my mind, but how could I forget thee? Through what power, even for the least division of an hour, have I been so beguiled as to be blind to my most grievous loss? That thought's return was the worst pang that sorrow ever bore. Save one only, when I stood forlorn, knowing my heart's best treasure was no more. that neither present time nor years unborn could to my sight that heavenly face restore. I wish I could do anything with language like that. So you heard the poem once, and again, it makes it really hard to grasp it all in one moment, but hopefully you heard the power of it. And you can hear in the middle of it, I mean, you know, the most powerful part in the middle of the poem is realizing that he realizes he had not thought about the most important person in his existence who had died, that he had not thought about them recently. There was something that had, you know, preoccupied his mind, and whatever it was, he had not been thinking about, presumably her. And instead, you know, it takes this moment, surprised by joy, to bring him to a point of saying, I've got to tell, who do I tell? But you. And then it's as if he's already standing at the tomb. You, long buried in the silent tomb, that spot which no vicissitude can find. And it was love. It was faithful love. It's been faithful that recalled you to my mind. But how could I forget you? And then when he realized he's forgotten, he says, this is the worst moment of my entire life. That realizing that I had forgotten you, that I'd been so beguiled as to be blind to my most grievous loss. And by the way, in this moment, you know, for those who grieve, it's the guilt he has because he actually experienced joy when he should have been, in his mind, constantly grieving, never forgetting the loss. And so now it's joy that makes him have the second greatest encounter with sorrow, with grief, pang of sorrow that he ever bore. And that is realizing that he was not thinking about her for a moment. And that moment made him remember her and made him think about the first moment, that first moment of grief, which ends not with a line of misery and pain. It is a line of sorrow and nostalgia. Nostalgia that could never be fully satisfied, obviously, because she can't come back. And so he says, you know, this was the worst pang that sorrow ever bore, except for one, the one when I stood for the first time forlorn, knowing my heart's best treasure was no more, and that neither present time nor years unborn, even if I could go back in time, nothing could to my sight that heavenly face restore. The death was insurmountable. That sorrow in the last line is simply expressed in the statement, could to my sight that heavenly face restore. In that nostalgia, in that longing, there is the close to a poem that begins with the words, surprised by joy. Ambiguity in poetry is the thing. I mean, semantic density, that is the thing. And what you think of as you're reading through the poem the first time, and there's no, I'm not pretending this is the singularly correct way to read this poem. I'm not saying that at all. But you should recognize this as part of what's going on. When you first read the words, they're the distraction. So when you read the words, surprised by joy, and this is the title of the poem, for crying out loud. You think it's going to be, this is going to be fantastic. It's a cloud and a bird and a flower. It was just wonderful. And then a frog jumped on them and spoke like Kermit. It was just great. That, and then it's none of that. You get three words, surprised by joy, and then the word impatient. Now, I'm already, I'm discontent because I've got to turn. And then immediately it's the tomb that I'm drawn to. So you're out of the joy immediately. And it's as if surprised by joy is the distraction, right? So I was surprised by joy. And then I realized how miserable it was that I had forgotten to think about my long lost loved one. And now I'm so sorry for that. And I've gone all the way back to the tomb and realized how sorry I am not to be able to see your face anymore. That joy was the distraction, but I've ended up in misery. But this is more than that, because the poem is surprised by joy. The poem, The title is also Surprised by Joy. So the first three words are, I was surprised by what joy did to me. Joy gave me a nostalgia for the thing I had lost in such a way that I was brought to appreciate again, for the first time since it actually happened, to appreciate again just how magnificent the thing was that I had lost. That I would never have to my sight restored that heavenly face, right? That's the point, that being surprised by joy isn't, I'm just happy and giddy. Being surprised by joy is being taken aback by longing, by nostalgia for something we can never hold on to in this world. And you can just hear how in this poem, if C.S. Lewis were caught up in this poem and working his way through it, how he would just have to title his autobiographical discussion of how he came to faith as Surprised by Joy, which was all kicked off by a pang, a longing. If I remember correctly, he literally uses the word a pang that he has at this little thing that he builds, you know, and looks at and desires it so much. And that's the word that Wordsworth uses here. It was the worst pang that sorrow ever bore, that nostalgia for the things that last. Well, we got through three of our five poems, and I had two more in order to tie it all together. We'll do those another day, maybe soon. I don't know. But the point, I would say, you know, see these three at least together to say, and let's treasure the moments that we have, the gifts that we have, the opportunities that we have, and give those back to God while the sun is still shining.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.